Hey, everybody, this is Dr. Adam Rindy. Welcome to this week's episode of the One Thing Podcast. In this episode, I welcome on Kim Beal, who's a pharmacist by training and is the co-founder and managing director of nutritional therapy for IBD. This is a nonprofit that's dedicated to establishing the evidence-based nutritional therapy as a foundational part of IBD care. She looks at all the research and helps integrate the best advice possible for people who are recently diagnosed or living with IBD. So this is a great resource for Crohn's and colitis patients to turn to with nutrition information and tools and resources to make decisions on how to implement diet and nutrition therapies for IBD. I was first introduced to Kim through her relationship with one of my most cherished colleagues who has now since passed, Trina Seligman, Dr. Trina Seligman, who was a mentor of mine who recently passed away. And we discussed this relationship further into the podcast. This episode is dedicated to Trina and also to those people who are suffering from Crohn's and colitis. And we are discussing in this episode many aspects of the nutrition therapies, the different diet strategies that have been studied for Crohn's and colitis. We look at the details of those. We also spend a good deal of time of looking at what nutrients should be measured and monitored in Crohn's and colitis patients, in a discussion as well about biometrics as a tool to monitor the health and status of someone living with Crohn's and colitis. I think this will help set people on the right path if they're confused about nutrition and its role in inflammatory bowel disease. And I think knowing that Kim has walked this path as a parent of a child with IBD, you can really sense how well she understands the terrain and how well she understands how to navigate this as both a patient and parent. So without further ado, I welcome you to the next episode of the One Thing Podcast. Dr. Beal, welcome to the One Thing Podcast. It's so great to be here with you.
Well, hi, Adam. It's a pleasure to be here, and I really appreciate you inviting me to be part of your program.
You're welcome. And I think it's great to meet with you. I think we met realistically because of a mutual colleague, Trina Seligman, who recently passed away, and she was so active in helping patients with inflammatory bowel disease, and also was someone who struggled with IBD and did amazing things living with disease. I'd love to kind of start by just connecting a little bit about Trina and how you met and kind of your experiences getting to know Trina Seligman.
Yes, it really is special to me to be part of this program, Adam, because I really would like to do more to honor Trina Seligman, but she was just an amazing individual, that she persevered through so much, and she had such a positive attitude and outlook, you know, the whole time through her own battle and her own journey with inflammatory bowel disease. And I'm trying to think exactly how Trina and I became connected, but I believe that she had reached out to me. Well, we have a mutual friend and colleague, Dr. David Suskind, with Seattle Children's Hospital, but I don't know if he actually directly connected us. But it was really only probably about 9 months before Trina had passed that we had become connected on email, and then we've met several times over Zoom, and we just really connected on so many levels, because she really, you know, having IBD herself and valuing and understanding the role that nutrition plays in improving her care and helping her to manage, that she really identified so much with what we were doing. And from the very beginning, she said, you know, I absolutely love it. And I just have to be a part of it. And I said, well, we welcome that, you know, wholeheartedly. You know, we really need more people who understand nutrition in this space and can really help us to get the word out, the information out, and can help us to build the tools and the information and resources that clinicians need to be successful with patients. And so we were really, honestly, just getting started together. You know, we had several meetings together over Zoom and, you know, occasionally over phone and over text. But I really, so it, in a way, it might seem odd that I can feel so connected to Trina because I've never actually met her in person. But I was so deeply impressed from the very beginning, you know, like the emails that she shared with me and how involved she's been in the IBD space and as a naturopathic doctor and really caring for her patients and teaching them about nutrition, you know, as part of care and all that she offered from both a clinician perspective and from a patient perspective. She was really, truly ideal for the work that we really are doing to help patients. And just as we were beginning to get her involved, that's when she had shared with me that she needed to wait, you know, to become involved, you know, because her own health was declining. And, you know, it saddened me greatly, you know, and because we never had the opportunity to really take off and to have her as I would have liked. But yet I find her story inspirational for us and for me. Honestly, she is the only person that I know that has passed, you know, due to complications of IBD, that it was really the inflammatory process that caused her to need, you know, the double lung transplant and just, you know, all that she endured and then keeping up with her care through the Caring Bridges and what's going on. It just really hit me in ways that I can't describe and just made me feel like we need to do more with patients. We need to do more earlier on. Like, you know, she shared with me how long it took her, you know, to really be able to find nutrition because it wasn't a recognized part of care. And, you know, it always leaves me wondering if earlier interventions could really do more to change the long-term trajectory of this illness. And honestly, that's one thing that keeps me here working hard is we have a number of patients who've told us, you know, I really wish that I had known about, you know, nutrition from the very beginning and at the very start, you know, as soon as it was diagnosed to do all that I could. And that's part of why we're here with our organization to try to make a foundational role for it.
Yeah. Well, that was a really great, way of encapsulating some of the things that Trina stood for in her, you know, characteristics. And, you know, I think one thing I would say about her is she had a really unique way of staring really scary things right in the face. You know, really difficult things where, you know, some people might duck out of these facts or these things to confront and kind of retreat. She just stood things right in the face and faced, you know, her reality. And she did this for her patients, you know, in a very calm, measured, trusting mannerism. I think it's a really unique characteristic. And I think people really felt safe around her, as a clinician, as a person, just because you were going to get the real deal. That's so helpful in these times. You know, when people are scared and confused, to have someone who can hold that container of, you know, weighing pros and cons and weighing the facts and, especially when it comes to like a new diagnosis or, you know, something as scary as kind of a child being diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease and what's this mean, and to have someone who has can ask and has answers to the scary questions, or at least has a way of approaching the scary questions that can provide some comfort and understanding and a plan. So we miss her, she's left behind a legacy of things. And if anybody, you know, isn't familiar with Trina, for this work, there's lots of great YouTube videos of some of the things she's done in her lifetime. But one of them's really fascinating is climbing El Capitan.
Exactly. Yes.
in the midst of active disease, you know. So she's a hero, and she always did it with grace, and she did everything that she knew she possibly had at her fingertips and within her resources to kind of live, and we miss her.
Yes, I'm glad you shared the story of the El Capitan, you know, really from the very beginning. I'm just astounded that she did that, you know, with active disease, and she never, just the pillar of strength, like you described, and she never let anything hold her back, and she really lived her life to the fullest, and just a bright, intelligent, caring, and giving person, and a pillar of strength and inspiration. So I'm glad that we can both honor her here together today.
Thank you. Yeah, excellent. Well, let's dive into talking about the world of nutritional research for IBD and some of the big picture challenges and various things that are faced, but even kind of overlying that, just how you ended up working in this space and like your personal journey of helping kind of understand the nuances in research and applications of nutrition in IBD.
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, that I am a pharmacist. I'm a PharmD, basically a pharmacist with some graduate training. And, so I never really imagined that one day I would be championing nutrition, you know, really as part of care. But we have really just learned through firsthand experience, our son has Crohn's disease, just the true value of evidence-based nutrition, you know, as part of treatment and alongside medications, that medications are certainly still central and an integral part of care, but there is really a lot more that can be added by leveraging nutritional science alongside them. So that really kind of begins our journey into this space. And, that was about 11 years ago when my son was diagnosed with Crohn's disease just before his 13th birthday. And that's what's led us here today, that I'm a co-founder and managing director of Nutritional Therapy for IBD. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit that's dedicated to establishing evidence-based nutrition as a foundational part of care for inflammatory bowel disease, for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, because we believe that doing so will really improve the well-being and the health outcomes of all those that are living with this condition.
Thank you for sharing your journey here. And you were saying before we got on the call, you know, one of your hopes is, you know, and one of the things you hear about is how people wish and hope that there'd be like a earlier access to this knowledge, or they would have been provided a way to explore the role of nutrition. But in those early days, since you are a parent of a child and you've faced this in those early days, is it something that you're able to even conceptualize at that early stage of like nutrition, diet, or is it just sort of flooded with this kind of scary or concerning situation, like what's the mindset at that stage for most parents?
Well, really thank you for that question, Adam, because I think that really also helps drive it home of why we have worked to establish this nonprofit is again that I'm a pharmacist and my husband is a physician. And when our son was first diagnosed with Crohn's disease, we really dove in like healthcare professionals to really learn as much as possible and to really help with learning all that we could do to really help our son. And when we discovered the compelling data for exclusive enteral nutrition, it's also known as EEN, and it's basically drinking a liquid diet only for 6 to 8 weeks to induce remission, that it is extremely effective, 80 to 85% of the time. And has been shown with some of the highest rates to induce mucosal healing. That's actually damaging the ulceration that Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis is like an ulceration of the, intestinal tract there. And it was just astonishing that what could maybe be done for the underlying disease. And as healthcare professionals, we really had to champion, our interest in doing this because our son, of course, was interested to do it. And that was an essential part of that, because you wouldn't want to force anyone who wasn't interested to drink liquid nutrition only for 6 to 8 weeks. But that was really the beginning of our passion for nutrition is really observing within just a few weeks how it really improved his condition. And then by the end of the 8 weeks, how he had really a compelling response that endoscopically he had regressed his disease remarkably, from 20 centimeters initially to less than 5. And so we thought that's really, really compelling. And we felt that nutrition needs to stay here and be part of care as we move forward. And we're healthcare professionals and really had to seek this out and find this through a good bit of our own research, because nutrition isn't normally really even discussed at all at appointments or included, and even evidence-based in that manner that exclusive enteral nutrition is actually used worldwide as first-line treatment for pediatric Crohn's disease and, many other countries in Europe, Canada, Australia, Japan, but less than 4% of the time here in the United States. And that's partly due to unfamiliarity. It's not really used a lot here, so they're not familiar with it. And it has a perception that it's really difficult to do. But, again, as healthcare professionals, we felt a personal obligation to champion not just this therapy, but really all the evidence for nutrition and make it available to patients to learn about and for providers to learn about and for them to work together to incorporate it as part of care. Mm.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. I can relate to your experience having been a medical parent as well. And, being someone, who also early in the diagnosis, that was one of my ways I felt I could help my son is to, to really dive in and see what answers I could find in the researcher and talking to other people. And I'd say that's unique, to be a healthcare provider, that's your response. That's like what we know,
Yeah.
And I can see, parents who don't come from a medical background, don't come from a sort of background where they know even what questions to ask or have that kind of training, being overwhelmed in those moments and, sort of getting into medication therapy, getting onto treatment, and then later maybe being ready to confront the nutrition question. But it's great for an organization like yours to be able to be there in the beginning and make it accessible. So with that being said, I just want to back up to one of the questions I asked earlier that was sort of packaged into another question, which is like, what is the challenge that we're having with research related to IBD that makes it so confusing for people. I'm talking about lay people, like people who are, you know, parents or patients, not, you know, maybe not so much for scientists, but just like, why is it so confusing to say, follow this, you know, this is the best diet for ulcerative colitis, this is the best diet for Crohn's? Why has it become so confusing?
Well, that's a great question. And the reason it is because there's no official guidelines, you know, for exactly what diet or eat these foods and don't eat these foods in Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. And for that reason, it has stagnated, if you will, that because there's not a single sort of easy guideline, like if you have heart disease or cardiovascular disease, you can follow the American Heart Association diet, or if you have diabetes, you can follow the ADA, American Diabetes Association diet. And it's pretty cut and simple, but it's very complicated here in Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And there is a significant amount of data that is helping to uncover exactly what is going on and what maybe components might be part of that, and just different varieties and kinds maybe of evidence-based nutrition, not just one particular thing. And I think that is what has caused, you know, really a tremendous delay in having it accepted and implemented. But our organization, what we believe is that we really should track and follow the evidence for nutrition, you know, in the same way that we do for pharmaceuticals. And that even if we don't have all the answers, because likely we never will, the same as we do with much disease and much of our healthcare, but we really apply the evidence as it evolves. And so that's our approach at Nutritional Therapy for IBD, is to inform clinicians and patients about the latest evidence, the latest information, and then to help build tools and resources to implement it and as it evolves, if you will.
That makes sense. I think, you know, one of the things that happens early on in diagnosis with both children and or adults is the first reaction is, well, let me just look at what I'm eating right now and the diet and lifestyle I've been doing right now that caused this. So let me just do the opposite. Can you comment about that kind of conclusion? Because I'm always helping patients in those moments of, you know, saying, well, we can't necessarily blame this on, you know, the way you're eating now or the way you've eaten the last. And I think there's nuances in that, you know, there's nuances in it. And I think it would be great to hear from you about like those conversations, you know, where people are saying, did I do this to myself? Did I give myself this disease because of the way I eat? There's a lot of messaging that would say that, you know, if people aren't talking to a professional, they might conclude that they did. And then it can develop some other, you know, shame or guilt or other dietary patterns that develop from that conclusion. Can you comment on that?
Yes, and I'm really glad that you brought that up, because when we, as an organization, put forward, you know, the evidence for diet, to use it again as it evolves, to leverage it, we try to be very careful with our wording and our nuancing, because some data suggests that there are associations, right, with different dietary patterns that may be part of developing IBD. The picture is much more complicated. It does include a component of genetics and microbiome, and environment, and diet is a big part of environment, but there's many other factors, like antibiotic use is a significant one that's highly associated with the development of IBD, and stress is a factor also, pollution, rural versus urban environment, and there's many factors that come into play. And we, as parents, you know, we also tend to blame ourselves, and as well as patients do. And it's something that we really we really need to give ourselves permission to set that down, because it's absolutely not your fault that you have developed, you know, Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, or, you know, if you're a parent, it absolutely is not. It's very complicated. It's multifactorial. All the evidence leads that way. And when we talk about diet, you know, at nutritional therapy for IBD and our resources, we're really just trying to use it from this point of where we are today to improve it, but never about shame and never about blame.
That's really helpful to hear. And, you know, like I said in that answer, there may be things that people are asked to change about their dietary habits or nutrition, or they might decide to change going forward. But like you said, it doesn't mean that those were the mechanisms that led to this illness. They could have been there, but doesn't mean that they actually turned on this inflammation, turned on this disease. So good. Well, I'm glad we talked about that, because, you know, we're probably going to go into, you know, like you said, the what do we do now? How do we move forward? Before we do that, I'd like to touch upon some things that I think are often overlooked in this concept of how we assess and evaluate nutritional status or health status of a patient with IBD. You know, there's usually they go in for their colonoscopy. They're given some type of update onto how the tissue and the mucosa looks and how well the disease is managed, and either told stay with things or we're going to switch things up as far as the drug regimen. And that's kind of, if they haven't been flaring or haven't been on steroids, or, you know, there's sort of like a disease score they're given and sent on their way. But there's this other layer of evaluation, of tracking how the patient's doing, that I don't think a lot of people bring into the equation, which is like biometric evaluation, you know, where we're looking at other factors, you know, for example, grip strength and some other body mass. Can you touch upon those and how you think about bringing in biometric measurements as a way of a gateway of looking at how well nutrition is helping patients?
Yeah, I think that's an important point that you make, Adam, because patients often, well, they typically don't have someone in practices that specialize really in nutrition that are helping to follow the patients. And so nutrition is really relegated. It's often not even discussed at all. I think that's what you were mentioning in the beginning of how people can find that. So not only are they not really aware that nutrition plays a role, that they're not really assessed for nutritional status, right? And malnutrition is relatively common in inflammatory bowel diseases, you can imagine, because if you have ulcerations in your small bowel, which is most common in Crohn's disease, or, you know, in your large bowel in ulcerative colitis, that you're really not able to digest and absorb your nutrients well. The inflammation causes increased caloric needs. And so there's like an imbalance of, you know, protein energy, you know, intake relative to the higher demands, you know, that the inflammation places upon the body. So, you know, up to, you know, 40% of patients with IBD in remission even are malnourished, and, you know, up to 80% with active disease. And so they really need to be screened for that. And it's associated with poor outcomes, as well as sarcopenia, which is loss of skeletal muscle mass. And that is associated with poor outcomes, with increasing inflammation, with hospitalizations, with surgery, with complications, with infections. And so if we can really catch this early on and try to catch patients that are at higher risk and intervene more quickly, we can really, you know, improve their outcomes.
Yeah. And I think these are tools and measurements that have lots of data behind them. and large population studies of, kind of norms, and they're easy to track. And it also, like you said, so for, let's take one of them, for example, like grip strength. That one is really coming up a lot these days, because of, well, for one thing, it's a quasi measurement of sarcopenia, or also mitochondrial function. I'd love for you to talk about that. Like, if an IBD patient comes into their doctor, say once every 6 months, and their doctor's checking their grip strength, what is that providing for that patient? Like, what can we do about that? Like, if we're starting to see that it's declining, is that the impetus of, sort of preventative medicine, seeing those little nuances?
Yes, I think you said that well in terms of preventative medicine, because, typically, body mass index has been used really to evaluate for malnutrition. But it's really not the most sensitive indicator, because, people can have a larger body mass index but still be malnourished. They can be undernourished and overweight, and it really doesn't account for skeletal muscle mass well. And hand grip strength tends to be, and mid arm muscle circumference tend to be a more reliable measure in patients with IBD. And I understand hand grip strength also, really with frailty, it's been able to identify that as really a risk factor also for elderly patients. And so when you see that declining, then you know that there's a process of a poor nutritional status that is really underlying that, and that you can really help to improve that by, to some protein supplementation, some like essential amino acid supplementation, with protein with combined with like some resistance training that has been shown to be more effective to improve muscle mass and strength. And again, that would be associated with improving their outcomes. So catching it early, right? And that's something that we can do. And it's recommended now to actually do routinely, but not that many people are aware of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's always, having been in situations where you see patients or loved ones that are hospitalized or on the ICU or in these really unfortunate settings, you can seeing like the difference between someone who's in a frail state getting out of that situation versus someone who's not. It's palpable once you see it in real life, to be able to get out of that bed and start walking. And so I feel like it's so simple but so profound to track these biometrics, not only for this to prevent this end result that I'm talking about, but also it's just sort of to validate and feel motivated to continue to do this hard work of working on nutrition, exercising, and these other things that take a lot of work and dedication.
So yes, and like you said, I think it's the catching it early and some of the routine monitoring that can be done by just assessing patients for their potential for, for being malnourished, what is their weight, are they having unintentional weight loss? Are they having, pain, symptoms of diarrhea? Are they, what you can still measure their body mass index, but some of the other indicators like the MUST or the Saskatchewan IBD nutritional risk tool has also been validated, that it takes into account, more poor appetite and other factors that besides just body mass index, and then combined again, like with hand grip strength, they can give you an overall picture. And then also, monitoring for nutritional deficiencies and micronutrient deficiencies, because These are also under-recognized, and if those can be identified early and treated, that those can really benefit for wound healing and really for fatigue and for overall care. So those are really important things that can be done routinely.
Yeah, so let's go into that one, because what what would you say is the current evidence for routine nutrient monitoring for patients with inflammatory bowel disease? And is it different for Crohn's versus colitis, or, what should we be checking and how often?
Well, at least annually it's really recommended to be checking for micronutrients, and then perhaps more when patients are symptomatic, right? And you notice that they're having. Because if you're having higher levels of inflammation and you're not absorbing your nutrients well, that you are at high risk, and a significant number of patients with IBD have nutrient deficiencies, as well as even the general healthy population, are even deficient in some nutrients. And so you can imagine if you have this whole process going on that you're really at a higher risk. So for patients with IBD, that zinc, magnesium, calcium, folic acid, because some medications like sulfasalazine, can interfere with that in absorption. Vitamins, B12 and B12 in particular for patients with Crohn's disease, because it's absorbed at the terminal ileum, which is the most common site of activation of disease in Crohn's disease. Vitamin D, as well as vitamin E and iron too, really, because associated with fatigue. So if we can monitor and maybe even catch early some of these deficiencies, that can really help patients to function more optimally and to be the best that they can be, and to help their body to manage best.
Great. That was really helpful. Yeah, I'm hoping, that they'll create panels, say that like LabCorp or Quest, where even the primary care doctor could just click on like an IBD nutrient panel and send it off. So even people with not a lot of nutritional training can just have that part of their annual exam. Because I do think the GI docs are overwhelmed with their part in the treatment. And so oftentimes it's like they just need to focus on the biologics or the medications or the imaging. It would be great. But yeah, that's something I try to do with my IBD patients, is check these nutrients on at least an annual basis. And so it's been really helpful for all, both clinicians and patients just to kind of, get that data back and act on it if need be.
Yeah, exactly. And vitamin D and calcium are important for bone health and patients with IBD. At higher risk for osteopenia and osteoporosis, and it's it can go a long way, like you said, for preventative, if we can really have to stay on top of micronutrients.
Yeah, and zinc is instrumental in epithelial layer tissue repair. Vitamin A and E are some of the main antioxidants in the body, so it's like this is the real deal. It's just not associative nutrient deficiencies. These are actual nutrients that can actually help with management of the disease. So,
And I hope that, I know that from our experience and really changing diet for more of a medical reason, I've just come to appreciate and value, just the quality of food in a way that I never have before. And it's just so much more than what we take it for at face value, that, as a pharmacist, I've just been astounded at the levels of which the foods that you take in can really interact directly with your body in a new and emerging field of, immunonutrition, that it can affect your immune system and the byproducts it produces. And specific nutrients, act that way cellularly, and I just think that's fascinating. And so when you think about your body and wanting it to function optimally, whether you have IBD or not, it just inspires you that, you know, who wouldn't want to fill their tank, right, with everything? If you wouldn't want something to be running low, like we're talking about micronutrients, and then something downstream can't function, like you said, for wound repair because you don't have enough zinc on board, or, you know, or magnesium or what have you for cellular function. So why not make sure that your tank is full in all the areas of the things that we know that it needs?
Yeah, and you know, the thing that with IBD is the resources, depending on how well the disease is managed, the resources are being used up at a increased rate. So it's, and also people don't feel as well sometimes, so they don't get as much nutrition or can't take in as much nutrition, and their diets become very limited. And so, yeah, I mean, this is so important, and you know, great to have structure around it, and so we can have conversations and you know, consistent monitoring. So along those lines, like, I think it'd probably great to start looking a little bit at the individual diets that are dietary strategies or structures that are currently being shown to have good evidence for ulcerative colitis. And on the flip side, maybe some of those that have a long way to go before we can kind of adapt them. And so like ulcerative colitis, and then maybe we can go into Crohn's disease after that.
Okay. Well, and for ulcerative colitis, you know, I'd like to mention that, you know, it honestly has not been as well studied as it has been in Crohn's disease, but you know, that doesn't mean that it's not effective or that it's not important. It hasn't been studied as extensively. But really nutrition, you know, it was really some of the earliest findings that nutrition was effective or played a role in IBD go back to like the 70s. And that's with surgeons getting ready to do surgery for patients and recognizing from case reports that patients going into surgery having exclusive enteral nutrition beforehand, what it really did to the tissue and to wound healing. So there's some evidence there that, you know, could it be that you're repleting micronutrients as part of that process? You're also resting the bowel and allowing the nutrients to be really more easily absorbed. Or, you know, avoidance of certain components. Those are all, you know, potential ways in which that's helpful. But exclusive enteral nutrition, even though that was shown as early on as the 70s, that was our earliest clue, it wasn't really continued to be researched. And so it wasn't really until exclusive enteral nutrition began to be researched in Crohn's disease that people really thought that nutrition played a role or that nutrition had really any effect at all. And so, you know, for example, like with my son and with exclusive enteral nutrition and Crohn's disease, it's a well-established, you know, well-researched, you know, the foundation of all dietary therapy is built on this exclusive enteral nutrition in pediatric Crohn's disease. And for a long while, people thought, oh, well, you know, it's not effective in ulcerative colitis. Well, the actual truth is that it really hasn't been studied, you know, in ulcerative colitis. That's the real answer there. But What I found really interesting is that, you know, there's been an article to suggest that really physiologically there's a process that, you know, one would believe logically that it could, you know, behave similarly, you know, for that benefit. But, you know, and there have been for acute severe ulcerative colitis where people have been hospitalized, placing them on exclusive enteral nutrition has been shown to statistically significantly reduce hospital stays, to reduce, you know, steroid refractory disease state and even colectomy. So I think that gives us an indication there that, you know, in those settings that, you know, it could be an option alongside medication to, if the patient is willing to consider even exclusive enteral nutrition, even for UC patients in that setting. And certainly before surgery, just, you know, whether you have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis.
Mm-hmm. And so that, I mean, that's more sort of in the, like the setting of these more acute flare scenarios. Say for example, the earlier you could get someone on board with EN, then the more likely we would avoid steroid use, avoid hospitalization. So taking it to more like a subacute level. So, you know, management of subacute active disease, like going into like nutrition after that. So there's like something called a partial EEN, right? And is that, and then even going further out where the patient is getting more and more stable, like where are we at with the research for dietary approaches there?
Yes, as you mentioned, you know, exclusive enteral nutrition is really meant for really active disease, and you're trying to get, and again, really, you know, predominantly thought of for Crohn's disease. I'm just making the point not to rule it out for ulcerative colitis, you know, alongside medications, because some small pilot studies have shown that there may be something really there that might be worth you know, having in addition, although it's not well studied. But then as you transition from exclusive enteral nutrition, which is the foundation of nutritional therapy, just giving us the idea that this does work and there's something in the food and there's something in the components, that there's a category that we call therapeutic diets, which are diets that have been designed more specifically for IBD or for autoimmune conditions and have been studied. And that would be the IBD-AID, the anti-inflammatory diet from UMass, the autoimmune protocol, and the specific carbohydrate diet, as well as the Crohn's disease exclusion diet. And again, the Crohn's disease exclusion diet is really studied in Crohn's disease, but the other diets, you know, IBD-AID, AIP, and SCD do have data for both patients with ulcerative colitis and for Crohn's disease. Now, when we talk about data, we're really talking about small patient populations. And so, and that's another reason why, you know, dietary therapy hasn't made guidelines yet in a bigger and broader way, is because the guidelines are built on randomized controlled trials. And, you know, these are smaller patient populations, and many of them are retrospective or observational data. You know, some are even case reports. But what we've really been told, you know, as an organization and coming to our website at Nutritional Therapy for IBD, that, you know, doctors have told us this, and all kinds of healthcare professionals, that they really had no idea that there was this much data to support nutrition, you know, in the management of inflammatory bowel disease. But when you put it there collectively, even though they're small trials, and again, you know, more so in Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, it really is rather compelling that there's definitely something going on here, and that, you know, if it's something that the patient is interested in doing and is able to do and can do so safely, it makes sense to invite that patient to learn more about it and, you know, and work together with their healthcare providers and decide if this is something that they want to incorporate.
Yeah, I think it, the organic process for most patients is, like you said, the motivation and interest to see if through nutrition they can feel better, manage their disease better. And then the what they do is really a kind of process, right? So using these structures of some of the dietary programs that have been placed to find, you know, which one is actually most effective for the individual. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And, you know, before we go there, I wanted to mention for UC that, you know, it's kind of exciting that, you know, there's really a lot of ongoing data, even in research and in nutrition. And for ulcerative colitis, there's an ongoing study in Israel looking at like a low protein diet, because some red meat has been associated with, you know, development of ulcerative colitis. So there's another diet similar to Crohn's disease exclusion diet, but modified a little bit more for potentially for ulcerative colitis. And then a little bit of data for a low sulfur diet that does, you know, sulfur containing foods as they're processed. It can combine with hydrogen. You develop hydrogen sulfide, which can be damaging to tissue. And so that could be another avenue in ulcerative colitis. And so these, you know, again, that's not well studied, but I mean, but it's, I guess it's giving us an indication that we're learning more about what's involved there. But these primary concepts of these diets, you know, as well as use of Mediterranean diet, that we haven't talked about the big picture yet, that there's all of these diets available that you're saying there's more than one right way to do it. We've talked a lot about active disease and using, you know, exclusive enteral nutrition and, you know, any of the therapeutic diets. But as you've alluded to, there's partial enteral nutrition, there's Mediterranean diet, there's healthy eating steps, that all of these are appropriate and good choices to add to your regimen. And it's really, it's about finding the right choice that's for you. And if you're interested, I can elaborate on that because we have a new resource coming out, and but I can go on in great detail. So
yeah, I want to hear about the tool of, you know, kind of maybe further into this conversation, you know, before we conclude, and you know, kind of hear how, you know, people can work with the tools to kind of enter this nutrition question. Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, just kind of off what you just said is that, and some of the comments you made about the hydrogen sulfide, and a lot of this, I think, will eventually come down to, you know, what the microbiome looks like in an individual and the metabolomics and what their particular microbiome is composed of, and you know what other digestive function insufficiencies they might be dealing with to find that kind of match of nutrition. And so I'm hoping these two worlds will come together, you know, and they probably already are. I'm just, you know, kind of as an outsider seeing like, wow, when they put those two worlds together, we're going to be able to match people with, you know, say, this is the right step for you.
Yes, I think we're really in an exciting time now because there's so much going on right now in nutritional research, just really an explosion, an exponential rise, you know, in nutritional research, especially in IBD right now. And so that gives me a lot of hope that we're really uncovering more answers here. And as you know, you've had wonderful speakers on the microbiome, and it's just, you know, we know that it's an integral part, and it's becoming more recognized that it makes sense to manipulate it as part of the healing process. And dietary therapy is the diet is the biggest influencer of the microbiome. So the pieces just really fit together well, that this is the direction that we should be heading, and this is what we should be doing. And I was really excited about the results of the GEM trial that had come out at the end of 2023, the Crohn's and Colitis Canada genetic, environmental, and microbiome project, that, you know, for the first time, you know, they looked at the microbiome longitudinally in, you know, people at risk, you know, for developing IBD, healthy family members and those with Crohn's disease. And what they showed was that, well, we've always known that there's microbial signatures, you know, that are identified with ulcerative colitis and with Crohn's disease, but that these signatures were really developed almost 5 years before actually being diagnosed with IBD, and that this is also another potential place where we could maybe intervene early if we really could recognize some of these you know, signs of moving in that direction and really, and, you know, a rise in calprotectin. And so there's more that we can do potentially preventative, and then even early on to manipulate that microbiome. If the shift is caused, you know, can we shift it back? You know, that would, it just seems to offer so much hope for resolving the underlying problem, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, it's great to hear this continuum of therapeutic dietary interventions. And, you know, I'd say like one of the challenges for people is getting quick access to the EN nutrition, like at the time of need. So, you know, curious, do people generally have a standing order for this type of nutritional therapy if they're flaring, or do they, is it something that can be like shelf stable, stocked at people's homes? Like, because a lot of people, when they're in that early flare, they need it right away.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and you know, that's the kind of the conundrum is that, you know, when you, because the commercially available products, you know, they can contain additives and emulsifiers, and we know that there have been some associations, in particular in animal models, and but yet we know when it's used exclusively in exclusive animal nutrition, it's still very effective, right? And so there's that whole piece going on, and then but they don't actually have to have a prescription for that, you know, that you can just you know, keep that on hand. However, you know, it's not paid for by insurance, and our organization is a member to really support the legislative act to have nutrition covered, you know, by insurance. And it's a long process, and we're involved with really trying to help advocate for that as part of care. But I hope that, you know, people that are able to afford it, you know, that's one piece is affording it. And the other is really just even awareness of how efficacious it is and that it can be part of your care. And one thing we haven't spoken a lot about, because I keep talking, I think, a lot about exclusive enteral nutrition, but really partial enteral nutrition. It's really underutilized and underappreciated that it's, you know, there aren't a lot of studies, but there are a few that have really shown some impressive results in terms of maintaining remission, like if you're on a biologic and intaking daily anywhere from 35% to 50% of your caloric intake as liquid nutrition, that it can help to maintain remission. And another study in the last couple of years to show that if you've had surgery, to statistically significantly reduce surgical recurrence. And I really like, you know, helping to promote awareness of that option, because we just talked about this whole array of options, but, you know, some people, they just don't feel like they can do that in their lifestyle to make dietary changes. Something certainly not as astringent as exclusive enteral nutrition or a therapeutic diet, but, you know, even Mediterranean diet can be challenging. You know, you eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, but just even partial enteral nutrition, I think for more people, if they were aware of the data, they might feel like that was something that they could do and that
definitely
they could have.
And especially like people with like J pouches and other kind of more advanced presentations of IBD or complications, you know, it's just to have that flexibility, or even just to default into a partial diet on days when you're just not feeling well, or you feel maybe the beginning onset of a flare. So yeah, I love that. And I think people really love flexibility and, you know, having sort of those balances. So I couldn't agree more. I think it'd be a good time to kind of go into some of the exciting tools that you're developing and hear more about those.
Okay. Well, you know, we really strive to, well, we're a global organization. We have 18 international medical advisors, you know, that are working with us, that are pediatric and adult gastroenterologists, dietitians, a nurse practitioner from Stanford, and 18 international organizational partners, Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, Crohn's and Colitis Israel, Ethiopia, New Zealand, as well as Pan American Crohn's and Colitis Organization, that were really, in addition to a number of different patient organizations, that there's really a lot of representation across the globe. And this is definitely a global need, that patients, more than anything, you know, they're looking for what can I eat? You know, they're hurting, they're not feeling well, they don't feel like they can eat a lot of foods. And we really want to make patients be able to reach a place, you know, when working with their healthcare providers, that they can improve their health through nutrition and get to a place where they can eat a wider variety of foods, enjoy foods again. That's really part of our goals. But some of the tools that we recognize are important, you know, to once you make a decision, for example, with your healthcare provider that you're going to try, you know, either whether it be Mediterranean diet, that's a good fit for you because you're, you know, or whether it's a therapeutic diet, for example, or even some healthy eating steps. What does that look like? And how do I make my foods? How do I go about my day? So we have a recipe database that is filterable. It has over 1,000 recipes in it. And it's filtered by and organized by different types of foods and different diets and special occasions or meals. And they've been vetted by all of our dietitians. So we think that's a useful resource for, you know, healthcare providers to help, you know, share with their patients and help them get started, right? You know, what works for them. And we launched that October of last year. And then we're working this year to expand that culturally, because I just mentioned, you know, we really have a global presence. We want, you know, more to be represented here. But a new tool that we're working on, Adam, is I'm really excited about that. We're getting close to having a functional first phase, that it's a tool for clinicians to use with their patients to go through this process of exactly what we've been talking about. How do you decide which of these options is right for that patient? We feel that it really can only be done through shared decision making, through a conversation about what your goals are with nutrition and you know, the whether you want to use it to reduce inflammation and symptoms for active disease, or if you want to maintain remission, or if you're having like IBS type symptoms, you know, within IBD, then that might take you down different channels. And that this should also be matched up with what is realistic and what's feasible for an individual given, you know, all that's going on in life, you know, the levels of motivation for dietary change, where you are, because you really want to meet patients where they are at that moment in time. And what are their resources? You know, that it takes, you know, to do a lot of cooking, you have to have access to a kitchen and to foods and the schedule and the, you know, time to do it all. So we're excited that we're getting close. And I think we'll be inviting different people to pilot it for us and see how it works, you know, with their patients. And so I look forward to sharing that with you when we get it going, you know, but it's coming along, you know?
Yeah, it's very helpful. It'd be very helpful because, you know, those early conversations are, you know, I think quickly could become overwhelming for patients and frustrating. And also, if what's being presented doesn't align with their culture or values or just the way the resources that they have, then it just kind of falls, and then nobody benefits from it because, you know, they're not getting the answers and not feeling better, and the clinicians are kind of not understanding why this isn't being complied to or followed. But yeah, those early conversations of making it match, making it work, are so essential. And I think for all of us, just being flexible is such a really important thing. That I'm learning more and more is, you know, just the more flexible and patient and scalable things are, then, you know, usually people can make those changes better.
I agree in that you really, nutrition is really more fluid. I think that's how we see it.
That's a better word. Yeah. Fluid. Yeah.
You're not in one box and this is where you are now. Your situation changes. And, you know, if you're in a flare, you might do this or you might, you know, so we encourage people to kind of look at it that way. And I would like to say too, that just like we talked about no shame and no blame, we also want to make sure that, you know, we're all very hard on ourselves, right? When we want to, making dietary changes is hard. It's hard for everyone. And I think that we tend to beat ourselves up over that and to choices we made. And I think we really need to appreciate the small steps and really recognize that and value that and not let, you know, perfect be the good of enemy of good. I think that's how it's said. But
yeah, I mean, we're in a good place, better than ever, to help people with this information. I mean, there's GI dietitians, there's even gut psychologists now, you know, GI directed psychologists, gut directed hypnotherapy. People are just super specializing in this world of digestive health. And so, I think all of this will be really great. Just, I keep coming back to this same thing, is like, things are moving fast and faster than we think, these days, than we ever could imagine. We just need to be ready to give people these answers, and the tools really speed that up. So thanks for doing that. So I think this has been a really great conversation with you. Hopefully the first of other conversations down the road. Because I think, this is just something that's going to build and build. I would love just kind of turn things over to you for some just take home messages, practical suggestions, and closing thoughts about ways people could support your work.
Well, thank you for that. We really appreciate your inviting us here today, Adam, and just really helping to spread the word, about our nonprofit Nutritional Therapy for IBD, that we're really here working in this space because we really want to make a difference in the long-term trajectory of this illness. And so we are working to promote awareness of the central role that nutrition plays, and to really have all healthcare providers work together in a collaborative way. Like you mentioned, there's so many specialists and people in this area working together that patients can benefit from. But nutrition should always be part of that discussion, with your healthcare team. And so we want to build the tools and resources to really facilitate those conversations, and so that we can find a way that works for patients, meeting them where they are, to bring some level of evidence-based nutrition into their care. And we truly believe that that's going to make the biggest difference in terms of well-being and health outcomes. I guess I wanted to share that, I think I mentioned this before, that patients, sometimes they're really just not ready for big dietary changes. And I think sometimes just even small things, can really be a great place to start. Just, trying to eat a little more fruits and vegetables and less sugar, and, less processed food or substituting honey, because it has immune modulating properties, in place of sugar. But these things are all well and good and easy to say when you're healthy, right? But when you're really feeling poorly or bad, I really want to recognize that, patients, that they really need to start slow and in a way that works for them. And that even when you go to add more fruits and vegetables, sometimes cooking them and pureeing them and peeling them and blenderizing them is really the way to go, that patients can slowly work themselves up to that, especially patients with strictures and all of that, and the misconception of fiber is one thing I think I would like to clear up, that, for a long time, patients have been told to not eat fiber, not eat fruits and vegetables, when honestly some of the most recent data shows that it actually prevents flares, right? And that we should in a way that's tolerable, right? Because it depends on what stage you're in, that if we can all work in that direction, not just patients with IBD, there will be benefit for everyone.
Excellent. Well, this has been really helpful, and I'm excited to share this with the community and the population of people who are, dealing with IBD, and just also family members of people dealing with IBD, just to kind of understand the landscape. And I look forward to supporting your work, and we'll get the word out. You're welcome back anytime you want to talk about exciting updates and things like that.
Oh, well, thank you, Adam. I truly, truly enjoyed it, and I loved how you had concluded that too, about getting the word out for family members. That's part of our mission too, is for that family to be aware that patients with inflammatory bowel disease, they have dietary needs, and that's something we can all do, is to support them, right? And help them through this process and just recognize their needs. So I love that. And I really enjoyed getting a chance to meet you and talk with you. And I just love all that you're doing to promote awareness of nutrition and as part of taking care of patients. That's what you do. And we appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. This episode of the One Thing Podcast. Please share these episodes with your friends, loved ones, colleagues, patients, healthcare providers, anyone who you feel might benefit from hearing these informative interviews. We tend to learn best from people sharing things with us. That's often the first time it's introduced. So don't hesitate if the content of these episodes reminded you of someone that might benefit from it. Forward the episode to them, and I'm sure they'll either appreciate it or be appreciative that you've thought of them. So once again, we'll look forward to seeing you next episode on the One Thing Podcast. And again, much appreciation for you being here with me.